Hey, you're not going to bed yet, are you? That's right. It's time for TV Good, Sleep Bad.
So I'm staying in my armchair. Go on without me if you must. So many shows on Netflix. And even more on Hulu Plus. Nonstop solid entertainment. Till my body turns to dust. TV is awesome!
Here are your hosts, Daniel Lackey and Elwood Jones.
Hello and welcome to a very festive edition of TV Good Sleep Bad. I'm your host as always, Elwood Jones, and joining me of course is my co-host, Mr. Daniel Lackey. I knew it was going to be one of those characters you were going to do. It was like, I wasn't sure where it was going to go, but I just knew it was going to be something Muppet related with you.
Yeah, that was a last minute decision. It was nearly Billy. From the Billy Manny Nearly Good. Santa Claus! You know, which might have been more successful, but hey.
Well, if you haven't heard a hint already, or read the episode description, tonight we are going to be looking at A Muppet Family Christmas, as well as the grim adventures of Billy and Mandy. So we've got, it's once again... a little bit of a twisted Christmas, but then again, that's kind of what we do here on the show. Because every time Christmas rolls around, we find some twisted Christmas special to watch. And I think, Lackey, this year you've certainly provided that one. So,
yep.
But before we obviously get into tonight's selections, we obviously have to ask the question, as always, of what you've been watching. And, I mean, what's been sort of holding your interest since the last episode?
I got hooked on The Good Place.
Okay.
I'm about 5-6 episodes into the first season now. I think I figured out the twist, or at least a twist,
yeah.
But I'm not 100% sure how they're going to play it out yet. But for those of those on listening who might not know what The Good Place is, it's a sitcom starring Kristen Bell and as a woman who dies and goes to not heaven, but what is called The Good Place, which seems to be this sort of idealized sort of utopia overseen by Ted Danson. Only it turns out that Kristen Bell's character was not actually supposed to go to heaven. Ted Danson thinks that she was this woman who dedicated all of her life to charity when in fact she was one of the most selfish people around. And, it's pretty good so far. And it's getting a lot of it. I know it's been renewed for its fourth season over here. And it's I can't remember the name of the creator, but he's the guy. I want to say he did I'm going to have to look this up, but I think he might have done something Better Off Ted.
Right.
Something like that. Michael Schur. So. No, he didn't. He didn't create. He didn't create. He was involved with doing The Office and Parks and Rec. He didn't have anything to do with. Yeah, for some reason, I just always bring up Better Off Ted. And apparently, he co-wrote the Nosedive episode of Black Mirror.
Oh, really?
So that's the one that a lot of people think is the funnier one. But I've often said that in America, if we ever, implement any sort of social credit type thing, with social scores like they have it, I'm just going to shoot myself because that's probably about the darkest. I know it's supposed to be considered one of the lighter episodes, but quite frankly, I find White Bear to be a jolly episode compared to that one because I literally have nightmares in which I have to be nice to people for credit. It's just so scary.
It's, well, as with anything in Black Mirror, you can look at it and sort of see where it's happening now. It's sort of like where we base so much on our popularity on social media. I mean, how long is it before it like affects our social standing in life, really? So the one that, I mean, I've been scared of what Black Mirror sort of shows us since the Waldorf effect came to life. So
yeah,
it's been a scarier place ever since that came through.
Since we decided, since about, you know, half the country over here decided it would be, vote in Waldo as president of the United States. That makes sense.
Exactly.
Let's do that shit.
But no, The Good Place, I've still to watch it. It's just recently started being shown on TV over here, but it's been on Netflix for a while. And as such, it's been sat in my watch pile for even longer. So I will eventually get around to watching, because I keep seeing all these like trailers written. It does look really funny and kind of wacky. And I think Ted Danson, if you're going to have like the godlike figure, just because he reminds me of the face of Bo from Doctor Who, I think that works.
I what he reminds me of is, I can't remember the name of the episode or the name of the alien, but the Show Me What You Got alien from Rick and Morty. Show me what you got.
Yeah, the big heads. Yeah.
The Get Swifty. Yeah, the Get Swifty. Yeah. You know, with iced tea and water tea. So honestly, I have to figure that if that were to come true in real life, their gigantic head would, you know, materialize in our atmosphere screaming, you know, show me what you got. It would be Ted Danson's head. Either that or Bruce Campbell.
Just a big chin, then, wouldn't it?
Yeah, just a gigantic chin with a mouth on it. And, you know, it's nice to see him getting back to comedy. Because, like, the main thing I know that he's done more recently was he replaced Lawrence Fishburne on CSI, and he was good on that.
Yeah.
But, like I said, I it's good to see him back in comedy. But I'm only about 5 episodes into that. And the other thing that I watched recently was the new season of MST3K.
Okay.
Which had they dropped on, I don't think they dropped it actually on, no, I think they did drop it on Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
6 new episodes. This was kind of like a weird selection in that they did Mac and Me, which I don't know. I don't know if quite the, I wouldn't necessarily say it's a film with a cult following, but kind of like has the lore of Mac and Me kind of spread to England?
Mac and Me, I think, I mean, I remember Mac and Me when it came out in cinemas. And it's only really recently they sort of been picked up by the Snarkcasters as,
right,
like, oh, look, isn't this fun film, like, really funny? Aren't these aliens sort of wacky to look at? And when it came out, I don't think anyone picked up on any of this. As we certainly didn't pick up on, like, you know, the McDonald's connection.
Right.
That, oh, look, it's got all these sort of like product tie-ins and stuff. And it's really, this is the problem I have with MST3K, more so it's imitators, in the fact that they just find anything and they just like keep poking and poking it and just like saying, you know, isn't this funny because? And it's sort of like, well, if you watch this in the context it was originally released, no one viewed it this way. It's just because you're now like forcing us to look at it in this way that, and like force this sort of humor that that is supposed to be funny. But I mean, I haven't watched any of the new MST3Ks. I know that yourself and Soto of the now deceased Leo the Unwanted like to go on about it a lot, so I know it's definitely got its fans. The problem is, I just wish that they would give you like a cut so you could watch the movie without the peanut gallery. Because they show so many of these movies I want to watch normally, but I don't want to hear like the comedy things, unless it's something like, you know, the episode we watch, Teenagers from Outer Space,
right,
where it actually emphasizes it improves the movie.
Right.
But when I'm watching something like there's a Kaiju movie they did in their first Netflix season.
I know they did a bunch of Gamera films.
It's I think it's Manda.
Okay.
And it's sort of like, you know, I'd really want to watch that just without the peanut gallery. So, unfortunately, the only cut we can obviously get that's streaming is obviously this one that's on MST3K. So,
right.
But yeah, they definitely love Gamera. They did the Gamera song after all.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. I think I'm at the moment I'm more excited for the return of Joe Bob Briggs over on Shudder than I am MST3K. And I think that's mainly because he knows when to stop talking.
Yeah.
He says his funny bit and then he just like provides the setup and then, you know, he just lets things run. And I think that's how I like my comedy and cult movie interaction. So,
yeah, it's an interesting thing because Mac and Me has kind of, it was one of those ones that kind of dropped at the time, you know, it was released and it's kind of like, it sunk like a stone and then it kind of got brought back up. Probably maybe about 10 years ago, and it started to, the sort of buzz around it began to spread kind of as one of the legendary bad movies. And I mean, it is pretty dire. And if you look at some of the behind the scenes stuff, I guess it was actually financed by Coca-Cola and McDonald's. or in part. Yeah. So, you know, and just, it's an ugly, tedious film. At least I found it an ugly, tedious film. But it is one of those films that tends to, you know, and this is one of the things that I have with my issues with riff tracks. Or I don't know if I should say it's an issue, but it's why I don't like riff tracks as much as I like MST3K or as much as I like Cinematic Titanic, because riff tracks will just do anything.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to say that's necessarily a wrong thing. There is kind of that market that Mike Nelson kind of tapped into there. But there's a thing about MST3K that I always liked, that it kind of introduced me to these certain sorts of, you know, low-budget obscure horror films and genre films. And some of them are pretty dire. And on the other hand, yeah, I can totally see your point where there are some of them that I would like to see apart from the riffing. But the part of the thing I think when it comes down to MST3K is that the best MST3Ks tend to work, at least my favorites, is that when you have this sort of thing like a Manos or a film like that that is fairly obscure or very, very niche, and that a lot of people, you know, might not necessarily have heard of if it were not for MST3K. And the problem with the first two episodes of the new season is the first one is Mac and Me, and the second one is Atlantic Rim. So three guesses as to what Atlantic Rim is.
Well, that's the Asylum rip-off, isn't it? So,
yep, it's the Asylum mockbuster version of Pacific Rim. And my problem with the Asylum, and this is something I have gone on record as saying loudly and as often as possible, is that the Asylum, everything that I've seen by the Asylum as far as their mockbusters go, to the extent I think I remember having actually a rather heated conversation with a drudgeon on the old Force Viewing podcast, which I don't think is available anymore, is that we were talking about Abraham Lincoln versus zombies, and he was talking about how original he found it. And it's like, this is a company whose business model, and my retort was, this is a company whose business model entirely relies on people going to Redbox kiosks while stoned and not remembering the name of the movie they want to see, you know? I mean, and it was like, you yourself will even say, how did you come across Abraham Lincoln versus zombies? You went to a Redbox and thought, oh my God, by his own admission, oh my God, Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter is out on DVD already. You know, that's the kind of thing, that's the problem there. And the problem with the mockbusters, and I also tend to think like the amalgam monster, you know, movies like, you know, the Sharknado, the Sharknados are the Arachna, the Mecharachna type things, with the, I don't know what the hell they are, they're like half machine and half arachnid and half piranha, crap like that. So they're like half crocodile and half labradoodle. I don't know. They're just so fucking lazy because they basically know they can take any old piece of crap and slap the word Sharknado on it.
Yeah.
Film, Ian Ziering being an idiot for 90 minutes, and they can automatically sell it to sci-fi, and dozens of people, dozens of hipsters will watch it. And it's the sort of film where I was watching the Atlantic Rim thing, and it's like there's a couple good lines here and there, but it's a film that in many ways kind of it's made under such bad faith, and I would say such conditions of such bad faith, and I would say the same for Mac and Me, that it's just not a fun movie to watch and make fun of to me. It's just...
This seems a little obvious. This seems a little obvious if you're, like, making fun of an Asylum movie. You're not really trying too hard.
Right.
Whereas if you, as I say, if you take something like Your Hunter of the Future, for example, you're going to have to work a little harder for that. Or if you did, like, a kung fu movie and, like, it would require a little more effort. But if you're doing something like The Asylum, which is bad already, and very obviously bad, then it just becomes a little too lazy.
Right. And I think the same goes for Mac and Me. Whereas I think that if you find something that is bad but is made by people who are pouring their heart and souls into it, I mean, when you get something like Manos, those I think tend to work the best for MST3K. There's got to be some attempt on the part of the cast to be trying to make some quality, or at least to do something, beyond just let's slap a couple of things. This is not together and just, sell it to the same idiots who always buy stuff like this. I mean, it's not always the case that those are always the best. MST3K is the best episode of the new season, I thought, was a riff on Ator the Fighting Eagle, which is a Conan the Barbarian ripoff made by, I think, I believe the director of that was our old friend Joe D'Amato, Italian exploitation filmmaker extraordinaire, director of about 90 films with the name of Manuel in the title, and of Anthropophagus. It's a Conan. It's a pure Conan ripoff. But for whatever reason, I really kind of dig like the Sword and Sorcery ones that have been the last couple. They did like two 80s fantasy movies last season, and I thought those were hilarious. An original one and then a sequel. But there's other ones with Star Clash, something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
That is the sort of thing where I could actually imagine watching that film without the riffing and enjoying it because I'm like almost like a Troll 2 level because it is just so bizarre in that sense. But yeah, when you get to something that is like a legendary bad film or something where the people who are making it just don't fucking care.
Yeah.
Which is, the case with The Asylum. They just want to get something out with a couple recognizable stars and something that will make lots of money. These films sort of, they make fun of themselves, really. And it just seems like, but then again, it's possible that they're doing these sort of things to get a little bit more attention or because they may need a little bit more, I don't know. I would think that there is kind of enough buzz around MST3K, but those seems like two very odd films to maybe start a season with. I mean, like I wouldn't necessarily, be interested in watching MST3K do like Troll 2 or Birdemic. I wouldn't really be interested. I was really kind of like Mac and Me. Nah. But it's not, the new season isn't as good as I thought the last season was.
Yeah.
I think in a few other ways, I think in terms of the host segments, You know, I think Felicia Day and Patton Oswalt have really kind of slipped, and they're more comfortable in their characters now. I think Jonah Ray is more comfortable in his role. There's kind of a confidence here that I think the first few episodes of the 11th season were very much kind of can we do this? Will people accept this? You know, will people accept new Mads? Will they accept the new host? Will they accept new voices for the robots?
Yeah.
And, you know, the two robots, the two new bots, Growler and Waverly, that they introduced in season 11, they're back for season 12. It's like I said, I don't think it's going to go down. I don't think any of these are going to go down in history as all-time classics of MST3K, but I thought it was pretty solid, and I laughed pretty consistently.
Okay. I've just been looking over the film list for season 11. And yeah, Wizards of the Lost Kingdom. That's a great
Wizards
movie.
Wizards of the Lost Kingdom. Oh my God, yeah. I swear to God, I think it's been so long since I laughed that hard at a film.
Oh, Wizards of the Lost Kingdom. I remember that on VHS as a kid. And At the Earth's Core, featuring, you know, my hero, Doug McClure.
Doug McClure.
He's as I said, he's all about, you know, seducing the exotic women and solving problems by punching them. And, if you ever get Doug McClure and Peter Cushing in the same movie, that's just gold. But yeah, Doug McClure, he was the inspiration for Troy McClure on The Simpsons.
That makes sense.
The more obvious one, but yeah, Doug McClure. He did a trilogy of great movies. He did Warlords of Atlantis, Land That Time Forgot, which I believe that MST3K have also done, and they did at the Earth's Core. And that trilogy of films he did if you like MST3K movies, you're really gonna kick out those even without the Peanut Gallery. So
I don't think that there are any riffs in the new season that are as good as, like, Cry Wilderness. I remember I just cracked up at Cry Wilderness. I was really on board. If I recall correct, that was the one that really got me on. Cry Wilderness was the one that really got me on board. And that's really just been about it. Caught up with This Is Us. I really liked the plot where they, Kevin and his new girlfriend go to Vietnam to seek out, get some idea of what their father went through when he was, you know, fought in the Vietnam War. Finished off the Little Drummer Girl miniseries that the people did. And yeah, that's pretty much been it.
Okay. Yeah, it's not been a huge amount for myself. I mean, a lot of stuff is still being carried over from the previous episodes, so still watching Goblin Slayer, which is fun. Main ones, really, for myself. First off, it would be Kidding, which is a joint venture with Jim Carrey and Michelle Gondry. And,
that's interesting. Actually, why am I saying it's interesting? Like, it's a weird idea of those two working together, because, I seem to remember something like... didn't they do a film together, like, I don't know, Eternal Spot, something of the Spotless Mind?
Yeah, they, it's good to see them obviously working together again, because I think that both have got a similar sort of creative mind, the same way that Gondry and Bjork work well together.
I would actually say Gondry and the Chemical Brothers. Because as much as I hate any attempt a Gallagher brother ever makes to write lyrics, I would literally say that the Let Forever Be video is probably one of the best music videos ever made.
Oh, yeah. I would recommend picking up the director's label for Gondry. The director's label series on its own is just really fantastic. They've got some great directors, and then you've got Spike Jones. You've got, you've got Michelle Gondry. You've got the guy who did One Hour Photo, whose name's completely eluded me now.
Romanek.
Those are the three sets I would pick up. The others are a little more hit and miss. You also got the guy who did all the videos for Radiohead, such as like Karma Police and stuff.
That's Grant G.
Yeah.
Grant G, who also... Grant G does more like documentary stuff, because he also did the Radiohead quote-unquote tour or concert movie, Meeting People is Easy.
Okay.
And then around the time Control was in theaters, he did a Joy Division documentary that's just called Joy Division.
Okay. But no, Kidding is... It's, again, it's Kerry doing serious acting, which I think is going to be... It depends on how much you enjoy Man on the Moon. And those sorts of movies. But basically, he plays this Mr. Rogers style character called Mr. Pickles. And the setup is pretty much exactly the same, but Mr. Pickles has got this whole, like, multi-billion dollar branding empire. And so much so that, you know, the adults are like, remember it as kids. And there's a scene where his car gets stolen by these carjackers, and they're taking it to a chop shop, and they're basically going through all the bits in the car, and one of them discovers Mr. Pickle's ukulele, and he like holds it up to his fellow little gangbangers, and they're like they look at it like they've just stolen some rival gang leader's car or something. They're like, we've got to put this back, and you just see him rebuilding the car and then returning it to him as he comes out of his apartment. And the series itself sees Jim Carrey playing Mr. Pickles, and he's basically suffering with his real life because his son's killed in an automobile accident, and he finds his marriage breaks down, and he's just basically forced to re-enter into the real world, because he's been living in this sort of very fantastical world of his own creation. So in his mind, like, everybody's sort of like good, and it's, as I say, it's like Mr. Rogers' worldview. And it's about him basically readjusting into society and finding a sense of normality for himself. And it goes pretty dark in places, and it's just really interesting, like, the angles they take and how this character sort of grows over the episodes. And I will say that it's a bit of a slow burn. So the first three episodes, you might wonder why the hell I'm watching it, but after that, it does get really sort of good, especially as this character starts to grow and everyone sort of settles into their roles. The supporting cast is also really good. You've got Frank Langella as his father, and you've got Judy Greer as plays his ex-wife. And you've also got Catherine Keener, who plays his sister, on there as well. So it's a really great cast, and I'm really interested to see where it goes. I mean, it's a 10-episode run at the moment, and they have just commissioned a second season. So I'm really interested to see where this one goes. The other sort of pick at the moment is Tin Star, which is a Tim Roth project. Basically, he's a Brit cop who is basically trying to escape from his drink and drug demons by becoming a sheriff in this sleepy town up in Canada. So little crime here happens that the first time we go into the police station, his two deputies are both playing Gears of War rather than doing actual any police work. And the story itself basically sees him being targeted by these mysterious evil forces, which comes to a head when his son is accidentally killed in a failed assassination attempt on himself. And it's basically about him dissolving back into his old ways, and at the same time trying to find out who's responsible for killing his son. Just recently got a second commission for a second season. I'm still in the first, so it's one that's worth really sort of checking out as well if you like your drama a bit dark. And Tim Roth is, I mean, he's not done a bad project on TV. He did Lie to Me before this, and this seems to be another good one for him as well. So,
yeah, looking at the cast on this, it's got Christina Hendricks and Genevieve O'Reilly in it.
Yeah.
Genevieve O'Reilly I like a lot. She was, I think most people probably remember her. She's the Mon Mothma, plays Mon Mothma in the Star Wars prequels and in Rogue One.
Okay.
There's a Netflix, there's an Australian series called Glitch that I've mentioned in the past that she's in. And speaking of Netflix, I didn't want to cut you off here, but something just occurred to me while you were talking. The other big thing, and I haven't started really watching it yet, but it just dropped on Netflix a few days ago. And Heather Baxendale and I are both really excited about the new season of Travelers.
Okay.
Is now available on Netflix. And that's one of the Netflix's secret weapons. It doesn't really get a whole lot of hype, but and I was a bit worried about its future when the Will and Grace revival was really successful, because it stars Eric McCormack, who plays Will. This is a Canadian show. It's about people. It's kind of got your sort of Terminator. It starts off with your kind of Terminator / demon with a soldier or type concept, where it's about people who – the travelers are people who have come back from time – come back in time to the 21st century to change the past so they can change their future. But kind of the twist there is they can't actually – their bodies can't travel through time, only their minds can. So they have to basically hijack people's bodies and erase their consciousnesses and take over other people's bodies. So they have to take people who are about to die. And they had will be its third season. The first season, the second season had I don't remember his name, but he was the guy that played Veronica Mars's father. Kent Leone, I think, is his name. And this third season looks like it's going to pick up. It looks like it's going to do some pretty good stuff here. So I'm stoked for it.
Awesome. But, as I said, it's been a bit of a quiet month on TV. At the moment, it's just there's so much to consume in so many different formats, both in terms of, like, music and film and video games. It's finding time to balance it all, and it's not too easy. So at the moment, I'm just trying to, like, pick one or two things and, like, really sort of knuckle down and stick with them. I mean, I started watching Maniac on Netflix, which I enjoyed, and then we got into, like, the third and fourth season, and they're now changing characters, the roles that they play. And I was, like, thinking that this show is just so much stronger when it was them going back and reliving painful memories, be it Jonah Hill having to deal with the night of his brother's engagement where he attempted to kill himself, or when we look at Emma Stone's painful memory of losing her sister in another automobile accident, which seems to be a flavor of the moment for people to die in horrible automobile accidents. So I thought that those early episodes were, like, some of the strongest, and I think I need to give it more time. I need to watch the whole season and see where they're going, but certainly visually it's very interesting, and it's from the creator of True Detective, so it's got that behind it. But it's, I don't know, I don't want to cast judgment on it until I've watched the whole thing, so hopefully over the Christmas break I'll get that finished off as well. So but we'll see what happens. So, but yeah, I mean, was there anything else you watched at all, or was that?
No, that's about the size of it.
Okay. So yeah, I mean, over the festive break, definitely sounds like I've got more to watch from your recommendations, and maybe I have to renew the Netflix subscription to dive into the MST3K episodes. At the moment, it's sort of, I'm going back and forth. It's like, oh, do I watch MST3K or do I want to watch your Bob Briggs sort of marathons that he did, because he's got, I believe, whether it's happened already, he has a Christmas one planned as well. And it's great the fact that Shudder are really sort of focusing towards bringing him back and doing his show, but just through their platform. And I think as we go into 2019, I think Shudder is really going to be a platform that's worth watching. I think they got a real good foundation in, and if they continue to work with, like, labels like Arrow, like they are at the moment, I think it's really going to be a platform worth watching, especially if they're now doing stuff with Joe Bob Briggs, who's, I mean,
yeah,
he's like one of my heroes. I don't know about yourself, but
he is, I think a lot of us too, who got into genre film, really, those of us who, I mean, he is kind of like an aspirational figure for a lot of people from our generation. Or if you want to talk about Xenial or whatever, but from that kind of cohort, you know, a lot of us did kind of, I don't know if I necessarily grow up, but we have that. He is an aspirational figure for a lot of us. I know I don't have as much familiarity. I know who he is. I don't have as much familiarity with him as some of my other people with both my interests. But I definitely, you know, when I heard that he was going back and he was going on Shudder, I'm like, yeah, that's going to be cool.
Because, I mean, it's so bizarre. I mean, for myself, I only discovered him through his writing rather than, because obviously his show didn't come over here to the UK. I mean, it was too sort of local, I guess, for that. But it's for his books. Many of his later ones I'm just going for my bookcase and I'll try and find it. But he did one on Profoundly Erotic and Profoundly Disturbing. I picked up the books not knowing who Joe Bob Briggs was and was completely enamored. And it was sort of like through that I then discovered, oh, he did these introductions and he did like his driving column. And it's sort of like, in many ways, he's kind of like the American counterpart to what we have with Kim Newman.
Kim Newman, yeah.
Who is definitely, you know, he's one of my mentor figures in life. And certainly,
are you going to start wearing the cloaks and grow mustache and wax it?
You know, this is the thing. When Kim Newman does it, it looks cool. When I do it, it looks tragic. So
most people do it. It looks tragic. That's
the
thing.
I look like I'm going to a convention somewhere.
You probably look like you're cosplaying Kim Newman. There's just something about like certain people where they can pull off stuff like that. Gary Oldman can pull off looking like a real life Guy Fawkes mask. You know, he can wear that mustache and a Van Dyke beard.
Yeah.
And I mean, you could just rip his face off and put it on, and then put it on your own face, and then go around blowing things up and, you know, terrorizing fascists and all that. You know, you could basically, it would be like, you know, V for Vendetta. And Gary Oldman can pull that look off. The former bassist of NXS cannot pull that look off. I'm just throwing that right out there.
This thing, as we said before, Kim Newman looks like he's in costume, but he's not. This is how Kim Newman just looks.
Yes. Yes. He's another figure. I know who he is. He shows up. He used to show up a lot on the Doctor Who DVDs and special features, the classic series. He'd be there talking about things, putting things in historical perspective and all that. He'd be one of like the very few accurate people on there. You know, because occasionally you would get the idiot who thought that yes, when Peter Petrachi, you know, designed the TARDIS console in 1963, he did imagine a full complement of TARDIS pilots being six. No, you know, but yeah. I mean, moreover, I don't know if his film writing has made it over here so much as we know him for like his fiction, like stuff like the Anno Dracula stuff.
Speaking of Doctor Who, I do have a question for you on Doctor Who. And is it true that in like one of the first episodes that the camouflage circuit of the TARDIS gets broken, and that's why it constantly looks like a police phone box?
It's not an early episode of the series. It has always looked like a police box. I don't know at what point. I'm not 100% sure at one point they specifically say chameleon circuit is the correct term for it.
I got that part right then.
Yeah, chameleon circuit. And I think chameleon circuit, that phrase was actually coined in the Target novels. and didn't make its way actually into the show until 1980.
Okay.
But no, the TARDIS always on the show has there isn't an episode. It's not like the TARDIS looked like various things and then there's an episode in which it breaks and it's just a police box from that point forward. It's always a police box. But yes, there's like a camouflage. They call it the chameleon circuit, or if you watch the Paul McGann TV movie, I guess they call it a cloaking device, because fucking Star Trek. And but yeah, I mean, but it's not like it actually happens. It's not like the you actually see it as something that happens over the course of the show.
Okay.
There's like there was like one story in the Colin Baker era where the Doctor actually fixes the chameleon circuit. And it does all sorts of goofy stuff, and then it breaks again and becomes a phone box, a police box.
Yeah.
And then in one of the episodes from the 40th anniversary year, they did with Matt Smith under Moffat's tenure, you actually do get a glimpse of the TARDIS, what the TARDIS actually looked like without that circuit active, because there's a flashback to the Hartnell Doctor on Gallifrey before the show ever starts.
Okay.
But if you're specifically asking, do we ever see that event happen? No, we do not.
No, I wouldn't show it happen. I just show it was like something that they mentioned as to why it's always a police phone box. So
yes, it's mentioned. I just like a lot of things in Doctor Who mythology or backstory that a lot of people assume have always been there. This is something you probably already know, that Time Lords weren't actually even named or introduced until the end of the Troughton era. And earlier Hartnell episodes actually imply that the Doctor is actually a human from the future and not an alien.
Yeah.
But stuff like a lot of things that people assume have always been part of the mythology don't really start to actually be mentioned until the early 70s.
Cool. Well, since you're obviously, you're obviously an expert on Doctor Who, as we've established on numerous episodes of this show, and perhaps you'd also want to shed some light on your selection for obviously this episode, which is The Grim Adventures of Billy and Mandy, a show which I never heard of. So this is my first introduction to the show. We're obviously looking at the Christmas episode, which I believe they save Billy and Mandy Save Christmas. Is that right?
Billy and Mandy Save Christmas. I'm actually not all that familiar with Billy and Mandy myself.
Okay.
This was something that was actually, and I'm something that was actually turned me on. I used to write for a site called Forced Viewing. We had a podcast, and I believe we covered Billy and Mandy Save Christmas for the podcast. And it was the Drudgeon, an old friend of mine, who wrote for Forced Viewing. He is just absolutely mad about special episodes, not even so much Christmas specials, but just like episodes of Christmas.
Yeah.
Christmas episodes of various shows. And he showed me this one. And I liked it. I didn't enjoy it. I don't think I enjoyed it so much that I felt the need to go investigate the rest of the Billy and Mandy series. But certainly it kind of made an impression, and it kind of made it to the short list of things to cover eventually on our very festive Christmas episode. So this is a series that was on Cartoon Network in the early 2000s, and this was kind of the same era as things like Powerpuff Girls and Dexter's Lab and other things that were explicitly not they kind of operated. I've talked about this before, where you kind of have like two styles of cartoons that are done for both kids and adults, and you have one that's sort of done in a way that the humor can appeal to both kids and adults, and then you have another one where you basically have two levels of jokes going on, one for the kids and one for the older viewers.
Yeah.
And this is very much in the style of the stuff that the Cartoon Network was doing at the time with their cartoon stuff, where it had stuff that was working on the two levels. It would make one set of jokes for the kids and one set of jokes for the adults. You can probably tell by the design here, while this was not actually created by, while this was not created by Jendy Tartakovsky, who, Jendy Tartakovsky, is the creator of Samurai Jack and I think Dexter's Lab. Hmm. And I think he's also gone on to do for the films. He's done the Hotel Transylvania series.
Okay.
He was a producer like Powerpuff Girls. He was a producer on Grim and Mandy, or its original version, Grim and Evil. So even though the series was created by a fellow by the name of Maxwell Adams, ATOMS, there are a number of characters that really kind of show that influence. Or I don't know whether this is something, you know, that Tartakovsky, not Andrei Tarkovsky. This is not Solaris. But there's like the sort of weird continuity of design between Billy and Mandy, and particularly in the character of Mandy, between Billy and Mandy and Powerpuff and Dexter's Laboratory. Like, you can tell they're all from the same, you can tell that they're from the same sorts of people, or that they all have like a common influence. But anyway, so apparently the setup of the show is that it's Billy and Mandy, is that it's about Billy, who is young and dumb and occasionally very loud, and who I assume is his sister Mandy, who is a little bit of a, I guess if you could just basically imagine like the composite of a character, every character Winona Ryder or Christina Ricci were known for playing in the late 80s and early 90s, and imagine them as a blonde character from a cartoon, that would be Mandy. And they have a friend who is explicitly the Grim Reaper. And the Grim Adventures of Billy and Mandy, they have Grim Adventures. And my understanding of the show is that there isn't really a whole lot of continuity between episode to episode. Like, characters can die in one episode and then show up with no explanation in the following episode. So in any case, in Billy and Mandy Save Christmas, I think is one of the later episodes of the series. I actually thought it was a standalone special, but apparently it's not. It's a fifth season episode. Starts with Billy, Mandy, and the Grim Reaper. Billy thinks they're in line to use the restroom at a mall, but actually they're in line to see Santa. Which results in the discovery that the mall Santa is not the real Santa, which results in them going to the North Pole in one of my favorite scenes, in which the Grim Reaper summons up a portal by which they travel through to the North Pole, and Billy screams, "A swirling vortex!" Where they discover that Christmas has been is imperiled by the fact that, and I understand this is the sort of thing that happens with some regularity on this show, Santa has been turned into a vampire. And it's up to them to save Christmas from the vampiric Santa, and they decide that how to heal or cure Santa's vampirism is to kill the head vampire. So they go find the head vampire, who has like a name like Count Grimson or Count Creepy Guy or something like that. and voiced by Malcolm McDowell, and designed kind of like the Gary Oldman Dracula, who turns out not to be the head vampire. He's just basically this complete neat freak vampire who just is constantly bitching about like the mess they made, and you broke that window, and what am I supposed to do? And he has a vacuum cleaner he keeps in his pocket. He tells them that the way they have to cure Santa is not to kill the head vampire, which is what he is. They have to kill the head vampire. I'm going to leave discretion as a better part of valor and keep from revealing the identity of the head vampire. Although, if you watch the episode, there's a point at which it should become fairly obvious.
Yeah.
But it's a fun little episode with a lot of just like goofy early 2000s Cartoon Network type gags. The one that always makes me laugh, and it's just this bizarre sort of thing, is that Billy has a big bulbous nose, cartoon nose, and there's this one scene where they're in Santa's basement and he accidentally walks into what looks like a meat hook and it pulls his nose off. Not that there's any blood or viscera or anything there, it just seems to just be attached like just randomly to his face. So he walks around for a couple minutes without a nose, and then just one sort of just spontaneously grows out his face. Mandy watches this, and her response is, "I wish I hadn't seen that." There is just something about that visual gag that just makes me crack up. There's also the casting. Malcolm McDowell, when we first meet the vampire count, he's singing "Singing in the Rain." I wonder what that's a reference to. Santa is played by Gilbert Gottfried. Of course. Mrs. Claus is played by Carol Kane from Scrooge and Taxi. And there are vampire elves. And I don't know if I would say this is one of the all-time great Christmas episodes or Christmas specials, but there's just a lot here that I get a kick out of. I get a kick out of Mandy's deadpan sort of cynicism. You know, she says, you know, when she talks at the beginning about how Christmas is created by the big five corporations as a sort of, you know, commercial thing, and, you know, talks about, you know, Santa being a big red slob or something like that. I really dig that. I dig some of the weirder moments. I dig Billy's boundless, stupid enthusiasm. Just about any time Malcolm McDowell acts really fussy and takes out his vacuum cleaner or sweeps things up. It's fun. Like I said, I don't know if I would put it on the same level as Emmett Otter, but I enjoy it a lot.
Okay. I mean, this is my first experience with Billy and Mandy, so I'll start off by saying it was a bit problematic for myself, and kind of the reason being that I really love the character Mandy and I love the character Grimm, aka the Grim Reaper. So those two characters together work fantastic. I wish that was the show. With Billy, he suffers from the same problems that Ren and Stimpy had, in that he's just full on all the time. He only has like one level, and it's, again, when I used to watch Ren and Stimpy, I love Ren, but I didn't really care for Stimpy because he was just too stupid. And with this character Billy, he's, as I said, he's not just stupid, he's like aggressively stupid. But he still has some good moments throughout, and it's mainly when he's sort of like left to his own devices and stuff, and he's like in Santa's office, and he's like got Santa's pen, but and again, this is another problem I have, is the fact that all the humor, so much of the humor in this episode, much like Ren and Stimpy, and I'm going to constantly keep referring back to it because it is kind of like the same sort of camp that they belong in the same sort of camp, and the no character can really do anything without it being absolutely disgusting.
Yeah,
and it's really sort of bugs me just how sort of fratty sort of juvenile humor they it is. So he's like, he's in Santa's office and he's like, oh, Santa's pen. So he's like, first thing he does is like shoving it up his nose and he's like drawing on the desk and like scratching up his computer screen and stuff. And it's all like the chaos that he manages to cause just by trying to do good, because he's sort of like so caught up in the Santa mythos, and he's like you kind of feel like the way the episodes go that he's going to become Santa. He's so enthusiastic. Which is like the doom is all worse than the plot that is actually afoot here. And there's a joke where he meets Rudolph, and Rudolph's got like a flickering red nose, so he swaps out the nose. And the next thing we see these two eyeballs rolling behind him. And does that mean that Rudolph's head just exploded, or what's supposed to happen there?
I think that maybe a cross-pollinating of gags, because there's another gag where they find all these creepy, in Santa's workshop, they find all these creepy toys, and one of them is, like, the creepy doll whose eyes follow you everywhere you go. And instead of, like, just turning around and, you know, following the characters with their eyes, the eyes actually pop out of the sockets and roll around. I think that's where that comes from.
Yeah, and I will say, though, that he has this great sequence where they're making gingerbread houses, and he falls into the machine, and he basically falls into the conveyor belt, and his head's been turned into a gingerbread house, and you see this gingerbread couple going, oh, look at this one, he has two bedrooms, we should move in here, and then he eats them. And, yeah, that was sort of his highlight for it. But, yeah, certainly Grimm and Mandy are a great double pairing. Grimm, especially because he's also, if you're a fan of Crash Bandicoot, the voice actor would be especially familiar to you. Because he also voices Atu. Greg Eagles is the name of trying to think of, but yeah, he's also Rokuto in Afro Samurai as well. Really great voice actor, and just the way he chooses to portray this character, Death, because normally when we see Death, he's sort of like, oh no, and goes stoic, and this one's kind of like he's sort of more jovial. He obviously has all the abilities of Death, so he can tear a hole in space and time, as we get that really tortured setup for, where we create support and then we cut to these two godlike characters like, oh, someone's tore a hole in the fabric of time.
But it's a swirling vortex!
I know.
I love a swirling vortex!
And when we meet, obviously, the head vampire character, Malcolm McDowell's character, and I like the fact that he's a kleptomaniac, because obviously that is a classic vampire trait. So that he has to constantly tidy things up. The fact that him and Grimm both have this fantasy of saving Christmas.
Yes!
And the fact that the flashback is just the same. They just superimpose Grimm into the vampire's place. I thought that was pretty funny. And the fact they have this stupid musical moment that they forget where they're just singing and dancing, but then they end up as just frozen blocks of ice, so they become douchicles. But no, Mandy is a great character. As you said, she's basically just Wednesday Adams, or
yeah,
you know, or thingy from Beetlejuice.
Yeah, I don't remember the character name, but you know, Winona Ryder.
Yes, exactly, and you know, perhaps to an extent, she's sort of like a more gothic version of Daria.
It's
sort of very jaded worldview for someone so young. Yeah, as I said, I just kind of felt, well, the whole time watching this, I kept thinking that if this was just Grimm and Mandy, I would be totally into the show. And like I said, when they're giving like the cast of starting, it's sort of like Gilbert Godfrey as Santa. I was like, oh, that's a bit of an unusual casting. And then you hear it, and it just like makes absolute sense, the way that this Santa talks and stuff, and the fact that he's got a contingency plan for when he's been turned into a vampire.
Uh-huh.
It happens that much. But I think this is very much a cult show in the very definition of the word. I can't see this having mass appeal, even though, I mean, this had numerous series, so obviously someone was watching it.
It was something that, like I said, if you, it fits in very well with the rest of the stuff that, you know, was going on Cartoon Network in the 2000s. It's very much, it may not be exactly like, say, Powerpuff Girls or Dexter's Lab or Courage the Cowardly Dog or any of those other cartoon things, but you can kind of tell there's kind of like an aesthetic there.
Yeah.
That it's like a Cartoon Network I don't know if they really still are very good at kind of creating that with the ultimate, you know, expression of that being, you know, the Adult Swim block. But yeah, this is like, again, this is, it went on for 7 seasons, so there was obviously like an audience there. But yeah, like I said, I get what you're saying about Billy. I think Billy is perfect for this episode. I do love the little bits every so often where it seems like he's a little bit more aware than you'd expect him to be. Like, you know, when they accidentally start a riot at the mall, and Grimm is like, how many times do I have to take the kids to the mall and you burn to the ground? And Billy's like, I blame the economy.
That was a great bit. Just the fact that when the mall is like a blaze, and the amount of tortured Christmas puns that they can link to fighting. It's sort of like, oh, I'm going to knock some Christmas spirit into you. And also, why's the mall Santa got a glass eye? It's like the creepiest Santa, and this is from someone who watches a lot of festive slashes. The fact that I'm creeped out by the Santa really says a lot.
He's got one of my favorite lines in the whole thing, though. Yeah, and Santa wants another $1.50 an hour, but apparently he's not getting that either.
Did you just say
deception is also a gift?
Did you just relieve yourself on my lap while you were telling me this?
Yes. That's a good, because you forget they had this whole thing where Billy needs to pee and then they seem to drop it. And then later on, you know, but there's all these other gags, like when they meet the head vampire, and the headed vampire, you know, gets this idea that they're gonna, you know, turn everybody in the world to vampires, and they promise Billy this position in the New World Order. And Billy's all like, Andy, I'm getting presents in the New World Order, you know, but it's just, I don't know. I like him a lot for this one episode. I don't know if I could stand to deal with him episode after episode after episode.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is probably the reason I haven't actually gone and investigated the rest of the series.
I think I need to watch some more of it for sure. As I said, it's just that Billy character is just so problematic. And I love the Mandy character, I love the Grimm character, and I could see myself following those in a series of Rick and Morty style adventures. And I appreciate the humor of this era. I mean, as you said, it's like when you mentioned about cartoon, just like the sheer amount of now iconic cartoons that came out of that series.
Right.
Because you had Powerpuff Girls, you had Dexter's Lab, you had Johnny Bravo, you had Cow and Chicken. And I remember watching these, because I was in a beaver at the time, and the only English channel we could get was Cartoon Network, and we just used to watch Cartoon in the evening when it came on. And you would see, like, Cow and Chicken come on, and it was like, God, this is just absolutely insane. The fact that you've got these two human parents. And the song, the opening song is all like, Mama had a cow, Mama had a chicken, Dad was proud, didn't care how. That's the explanation. And because of the era, we kind of accepted that you had things like this, that you had, like, Cat Dog, and you had setups like Two Angry Beavers, and these really bizarre premises that you just kind of went along with. And it was kind of like very, it tied in, I could see why students liked it so much, because it's the sort of humor.
Right.
And now, when we look at cartoons today, and you've got things such as, like, Adventure Time, and which I don't get, so I guess it's this generation's
Powerpuff Girls. You don't get in that you don't understand it, or you don't get as in they don't have it on any of the networks.
Oh, no, I get it. We get it over here. I just, like, okay. I sit down to watch and it's like, I have no idea what's supposed to be going on here.
Uh-huh.
And do I need to, like, go back and watch, like, the first episode to, and, like, work my way forward? I feel like I'm very much, whenever I sit to watch it, I feel like I come in the middle of something.
Right.
It doesn't seem like a particularly forgiving show. Yeah, I see people with, like, these character t-shirts and everything else, and they all seem to really be getting a kick out of it. And I Adventure Time is just something that seems to have passed me by.
I think I've seen two episodes of it. There is one really, really, really great gag where they have the Icicle King or the Winter King or whatever character that is with the hook nose. It's voiced by Tom Kenny.
Okay.
And he's floating through space and he's, why don't people like me? What is it? Is my beard too long? You know, do I just bring too much frost? And then he, you know, he encounters this gigantic owl who just goes, "Ooh, you're a sociopath." And it's like, I just remember watching that and just cracking up to know it. I mean, I spent the entire week just randomly at random points for about a week would just go under my breath, "Ooh, you're a sociopath." You know, because it was like the last thing I even remotely expected to see come up in that point.
Yeah.
And it, you know, I think I would enjoy it more if I actually started at the beginning and watched it all the way through. I think it is one of those shows that you really need to do that with. But yeah, that's like the one gag in Adventure Time that really kind of got me.
Cool.
But yeah, this is, you know, this is from the, I guess, the pre-Adult Swim block or era of Cartoon Network when they had like these shows like Dexter's Lab, Johnny Bravo, Cow and Chicken, Powerpuff, Ed, Edd n Eddy, Courage, and, you know, all those that seemed as much as that they were aimed for college students getting stoned in the middle of the night as much as they were for, you know, your typical, you know, pre-adolescence. And again, that's a demographic. The stoned college student is a demographic they really learn to work very well with stuff like with the Adult Swim stuff like Wonder Shows and oh God, fuck, what are they? Aqua Teen.
Okay.
You know.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you can kind of see why Billy and Mandy in retrospect hasn't become iconic in the way that these characters haven't become iconic in the way that maybe, you know, the Dexter's Lab characters have become iconic. Or the weird thing is this whole Ed, Edd n Eddy thing now, where I know there's this one guy that I play role-playing games with. He runs our Werewolf the Apocalypse game, and he goes to conventions cosplaying one of the characters from Ed, Edd n Eddy.
Nice.
And it's just, you know, these things that are, or the occasional, you know, Johnny Bravo is another character that I think has somehow become very, very oddly iconic. Whereas I don't think Billy and Mandy and Grimm have become quite as iconic.
Yeah, Johnny Bravo, there's only one episode that I ever found funny. And that's when we end up on the Island of Beautiful Women. And there's something about that. I think there's a line that is like, "You smell good, do you want to smell me?" And ultimately ends up on the Island of Beautiful Men, where he's just being hit on by these pretty much identikit versions of himself. But I think that's one we may look at in a future episode to see if it holds up. But
I mean, we could probably do an entire spinoff podcast, a limited one, just going on like the cartoon block and the various things, even if they weren't necessarily part of that, but the various Cartoon Network series of like the late 90s, early 2000s, because you could also throw stuff in there like Samurai Jack, which I believe was an Adult Swim one.
Yes, it was.
But that was, again, Jendy Tartakovsky who did, like I said, mentioned earlier, Dexter's Lab. But the Johnny Bravo, the one that, that always gets me about Johnny Bravo is that the Mockingjay symbol from the Hunger Game games, books, and movies, I guess if you turn it at a certain angle, it looks exactly like Johnny Bravo.
You see, now I can't unsee it.
Yeah.
Damn it.
You'll never, that's exactly what the meme says. Once you see it like this, you'll never be able to unsee it.
Wow. One last thing I wanted to say about Billy and Mandy. There's a joke where they go in the wrong cave, and it's Luke with the Wampa.
Yep.
I thought that was really funny. So apparently the North Pole is on Hoth.
Yep.
So, but yeah, I mean, I don't know.
A swirling vortex will take you anywhere.
Yeah, this is a very, I think this is a rare sort of hit and miss sort of pick. And I think I need to watch more of it too. But this episode, it had some great moments, and at the same time, it had some real sort of detracting moments. And I think it really sort of lies on how fun you find Ren and Stimpy, especially its gross out humor, because I really don't like it when cartoon humor pushes it into a gross area. Like when you see a Santa Claus introduced and he's got like the hairy chest and he's got the belly button and this really grotesque imagery for the character. It's just not something I particularly gravitate towards.
It's sort of interesting because that was one of the things I wouldn't want to necessarily watch it 24/7, but I remember that's one of the things I remember that really struck me about Ren and Stimpy is that's almost sort of Gerald Scarfe or Ralph Steadman-esque grotesquerie. Like whenever you'd get anybody in extreme close up, you'd see like the little hairs sticking out of follicles or they'd have bloodshot eyes. Yeah. Or they'd have runny noses and stuff like that. That is very much a Crick Floozy, Ren and Stimpy thing. And and again, that's the sort of thing like that. I remember, like I said, at the time when I encountered Ren and Stimpy, and I know I've said this before, that like Ren and Stimpy was like a revelation in that, wow, you can do this sort of thing with cartoons. And it's obviously looking back on it, there's a lot of things that kind of came after that used it in kind of a way that that it kind of lost its novelty or whatever it, ability it had to kind of stand out and say, hey, because it was just done so much by the cartoons and by the animators who came after John Kirkfeluzzi. But yeah, that. I think I've said about all I have to say about Billy and Mandy.
That's fine. Cool. We're going to take a quick break. When we return, though, we will be looking at our second selection of the evening, A Muppet Family Christmas.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Cinema Recall Podcast here at ThatMomentIn.com. I am your host, The Vern, and on each episode, myself, along with a guest, we'll be talking about an iconic scene from a classic movie. Which films will we be discussing? Well, that's all up to you, because before each episode airs, we're going to be giving you a poll of great flicks to choose from. Whichever one gets the most votes, that's the one we'll be talking about. So, listen to the Cinema Recall Podcast on the site ThatMomentIn.com, or on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or Podomatic, or SoundCloud. Thank you very much, and hope you enjoy it.
And we're back. You, of course, listening to TV Good Sleep Bad. In the first half, we looked at the grim adventures of Billy and Mandy. And now we're on to our second selection, which is the 1987 A Muppet Family Christmas, which was a Christmas TV special, obviously starring the Muppets. But it's really noteworthy in the fact that it also proved a rare cross-pollination of Jim Henson Productions, as he also brought in characters from Sesame Street as well as Fraggle Rock, as all these characters are thrown together for a variety of circumstances as Fuzzy Bear and the other Muppets drive out to his mother's farm to plan to, you know, spend the Christmas, but at the same time Fuzzy Bear's mother was originally planning to go to Malibu, but now finds herself being descended on not only by Fuzzy and his friends, but also Doc and Sprocket from Fraggle Rock. who, despite originally planning to rent her place for Christmas and have a nice quiet Christmas, are soon won over by the charm and friendliness of the Muppets, and they all settle in for a mass Christmas while they await the arrival of Miss Piggy. This is a really wholesome production, but again, were you expecting anything less from the Henson production,
yeah,
really? So
yeah.
The special itself, it basically plays like an extended episode of the Muppets. And like the films, you basically have all these characters, they come together, they do little skits together, sing a few Christmas songs, and the real sort of draw of it is the fact that we have cross-pollination, and the fact that, you know, you have the Sesame Street characters interacting with the Muppets, and you have, like, the Fraggles interacting with Robin and Kermit. And each of these characters has their own little bits, and they all have their own stand-up moments, so it's not like this is a Muppet show, all the Sesame Street characters push the background. No, the Sesame Street characters have their bits, and best of all, Elmo's seen, but he's not heard. So it's a win-win situation for all.
Yep.
But, I mean, had you seen A Muppet Family Christmas before this, Lackey?
No, I had not. I had known about it because if my memory serves correctly, this was the actual first appearance of the Muppet Babies as well. If I recall correctly, and when they're watching, not as a cartoon, but in the baby versions of the Muppets, where there's one scene where Fozzie's mother finds somebody finds the home movie,
yeah,
of the Muppets and displays it, and then you have the baby versions of Fozzie and Kermit and Miss Piggy.
There is a bit of a debate over that, because at the same time you have the Muppet Baby sequence in Muppets Take Manhattan. Mm-hmm. As well, which a lot of people say was what led to the cartoon series, because the film came out 2 months before they did the cartoon series, and the cartoon, they did all 100 odd episodes of that in one go. They farmed it out to a Chinese production company and a Korean production company to sort of churn those out, and seeing what they've done with the Muppet Babies now, it's not good. the original Muppet Babies cartoon was great fun, and it still holds up. The new Muppet Babies cartoon is just got that horrible animation that Disney seem to like now, and it just is absolute garbage. So just ignore that. But yeah, as you said, I mean, this special. I mean, you do obviously see the Muppets, and there's a lot of, they try to put all this sort of background to these characters, so you, as I said, it's sort of like you see the Muppets as babies, and you see Statler and Waldorf are friends with Fozzie's mum, so that's the reason they're there. And despite the fact they're doing all these tenuous links for characters to be at the farmhouse, it somehow works. Like, I have no idea why the Sesame Street gang are caroling so far from Sesame Street, but, you know, you accept it. The same way they accept the fact that Swedish Chef at one point is going to attempt to cook Big Bird.
Yep. Big Bird manages to fend him off with a bag full of chocolate-covered bird seed.
He manages to somehow charm him. What's the song that they sing together? It's some Christmas.
Oh, God. I don't recall.
But, yes. I mean, the general thing is that, you know, the general being nice to each other and coming together, and that the holidays are all about family, is just basically what this special boils down to. And the only sort of real sort of threat or danger is whether Miss Piggy's going to make it to the house or not. So, but I mean, how did you feel the characters are represented? Because I'm right in saying you're a Muppets fan.
I'm a Muppets fan. I probably am not the world's biggest Muppets fan, in that I remember watching Fraggle Rock at the time, but I don't have a whole lot of memory of it.
Yeah.
Of what happened. I remember certain characters. I remember them doing things. I don't really maybe remember plot so much. I really haven't bothered with any of the theatrical films after The Great Muppet Caper. Like, I've never seen Take Manhattan.
Okay.
I've never seen Muppet Treasure Island. I've never seen Muppet Christmas Carol. Stuff like that. I enjoy the Muppets a lot. my interest in the Muppets is maybe confined to about the stuff that Henson did in the 70s and maybe the early 80s. My current interest in it. The Muppet Show itself is the thing that I have, I think, the most interest in, kind of like as a cultural artifact of the 70s. And it's kind of like an attempt to kind of do a form of television, like a variety show that was really kind of going down the tubes at that point. And really kind of the way that they work in this sort of tradition of vaudeville that no longer existed in real life.
Yeah.
In addition to the heart and warmth that Jim Henson and his core performers, Jerry Nelson, Frank Oz, I'm sure that there are others that I'm forgetting, brought to the characters, in addition to the technical, in addition to like the technical brilliance, I still have this sort of, when you see Kermit riding the bicycle in the Muppet movie, that's still a very magical moment for me. The Paul Williams song still get me out of that in Emmett Otter every time. I like looking at them from like the cultural standpoint of, you know, the 70s. And I have a lot of warm memories of things like Sesame Street and what I remember of Fraggle Rock. I remember liking it a lot. I'm not somebody, like I said, I haven't really bothered with a lot of like the later stuff, particularly like the stuff they did after Jim Henson died.
Yeah.
I don't begrudge Heather and Brian Henson the right to carry on their father's legacy. They certainly have that right. I'm not going to say they don't. I don't have a moral objection to them continuing the Muppet Studio. It's just, to me, it's something that is so rooted in that group of people. There's a wonderful part at the end of the special where Henson makes a live-action appearance, a live-action cameo at the end, and where he complains that, yeah, Christmas is great, but who's going to do all these dishes?
Yeah.
And that just had, that was a very emotional moment for me, even though I'd never seen this, because just the warmth and the heart that he brought to it, it was such, even though he was able to kind of create a team that did put together a team, and I don't want to give short shrift to all the other various people whose names I'm, you know, some of the names I remember, some of the names I forget, but not to give short shrift to people like Frank Oz, Jerry Nelson, Carol Spinney, who did Big Bird.
Yeah.
An amazing, amazing performer. But I just kind of like, there's kind of like a warmth and a wholesomeness there. And I think to an extent, I'm afraid that if I watch post Jim Henson stuff, it's not going to be there. and I'm not going to find what I'm looking for, but there is, I think, something in the Muppets that kind of speaks to our, again, our cohort, our generation. We grew up with this. It's wholesome, and I like to sort of, you know, it's wholesome in a way that normally I don't really truck with. You know, when it comes down to what are my tastes generally more like when it comes to popular culture,
yeah,
they tend to veer towards the sort of entertainment you see in the Billy and Mandy episode than the sort of entertainment that you see in Muppet Family Christmas, because, again, it's the thing about a Muppet Family Christmas is that you get all the Muppets from across the spectrum of the Muppetverse, if you will, and they behave like the Muppets do. You know, the Fraggles are very childlike, very innocent, but also very, there's like a thing about them that it's not like a worldliness, but there's an innocence, but there's an intelligence and really like a warm-heartedness behind that innocence. Statler and Waldorf make fun of everybody. Sam the Eagle is like, these are all weirdos. You know, Big Bird is a big yellow child. Bert and Ernie have their relationship. the Count finds Count von Count finds a Christmas song where he can count in the lyrics. You know, this is every Fozzie finds a snowman and they form a double comedic act. This is Rolf plays the piano, and he one of my favorite lines in this is how he remarks about how he loves a good out-of-tune piano. This is every Muppet doing what every Muppet does best. And I think that's really the benefit of this, is that you get to see it, it's a bit of a thin conceit to bring everything together. There's no story here for the most part. The closest thing you come to a story is Miss Piggy trying to get to the farmhouse. And there's never any feeling that there's, I mean, even as much as they say, oh, there's a huge storm, I hope Miss Piggy can get there okay. And Miss Piggy calls and Kermit says things like, I think you should just come tomorrow. I don't want you traveling out in this storm. It's too dangerous. You know that she's not in any real danger. And you know that she's going to show up in the final act, the climax of the final act, that warm reunion with everybody. You know, so there's not much of a plot here, and that's not why we're watching it. We're watching this to see the Swedish Chef interact with Big Bird. We're watching this to watch Kermit and Robin meet the Fraggles.
Yeah.
And, you know, these moments, like when one of the Fraggles, they give each other, they have this wonderful ritual for Christmas time. They don't call it Christmas time, but they basically just give these gifts to each other and re-gift them over and over and over, knowing that's what that's going to be done to them, being done with the gifts, not because it's the utility of the gift that matters, but it's the act of giving that matters. And there's this wonderful warm moment when one of the Fraggles, I forget which, gives the pebble that he received as a gift to Grover. And your heart just soars at that.
Yeah, I mean, to do something smaltzy and heartfelt as this film obviously is, it's very difficult to do. And it's like last year when we looked at Pee Wee's Christmas Special. And the fact that again, is a really wholesome and sort of smaltzy Christmas Special, but it never feels too saturated and sweet. It just sort of verges on it. And again, it's very much the case with this one. And you're right, it's really fun to see these characters again, and the fact that we get all your favourite characters together and interacting in something that we didn't think you would ever see, this sort of crossover between the worlds. So it's kind of mind-blowing in that respect. And this provides a lot of fan service. And they do use these characters perfectly. Even like the more random characters, such as they do a telling of The Night Before Christmas, but they use all the monsters from Sesame Street, including the two-headed monster as Father Christmas, which just leaves Sam the Eagle in just despair of what they're doing to this classic poem. And I thought that those were really good. It detracts you from some of the issues, such as why does Robin the Frog have no neck? And he just looks really awkward and uncomfortable the whole way through this film. Every time he's on the screen, it's worse. They put him next to Kermit, so the problem becomes even more apparent. You just have like the Swedish Chef complaining the fact that the kitchen's full of rats and chickens because you know they've got to work those characters in somehow. So, there's something about this special. It just really is the Muppets at doing what they do best, and it's funny you should obviously say that you've not seen anything past Great Muppet Caper, because there is good stuff after that, like Muppets Treasure Island's really good, and Muppets Christmas Carol I know has its fans, and even when we look at the more modern stuff, like the most recent incarnation of the Muppet Show, where it was done like 30 Rock, and mm-hmm. it was, and it's something I think we're going to look at on a future episode, because I felt it was very, it's another of those things that the fans killed it by it not being, because it wasn't what they were expecting. It was the show creators are trying to do something modern and something different, and a lot of the fans were like, oh, it's not what I wanted. I wanted it to be like how I remember it being.
Right.
And the same way that when we heard Ghostbusters Answer the Call, the Lady Ghostbusters. What would have been a really fantastic introduction in this whole Ghostbusters universe, they killed Deb because, you know, they just wanted to bitch and moan the fact it's four women instead of four guys playing Ghostbusters. And I'm sitting there watching this, like, the only people who have any right to sort of bitch and moan about this not being the same is the guys who made it. And they've all got cameos in this film. So
yeah. If
they had an issue, I don't think they would be there.
Right.
So I think with the Muppets, they've always sort of suffered with the fact that the established fan base have always wanted them to remain the same, and the creators have tried to constantly have them move with the times. And
rightly so. I mean, you know, for anything to really be kind of sustainable in that sense, you've got to be able to kind of reflect the times. I will say, I didn't, and maybe this was a mistake on my part, and if we do ever, you know, cover the new Muppet show, certainly I'll look at it with an open mind, but I'm very much of the sort of thing, if I, you know, when I think of a Muppet show, I want a show that's kind of like a parody, a loving parody of a variety show or a vaudeville show.
Yeah.
I'm not going to get that because that's not what we do anymore. You know, so my kind of attitude was, there didn't seem to be anything in the new Muppets that I really kind of needed to get out of them, and that I kind of wanted to preserve my memories of them. You know, I don't need to go and renew. I don't need to go and update them for a new generation. For my own edification, I could just watch old episodes of the Muppet Show.
Yeah.
But certainly, and again, I'm not going to look down on Brian and Heather Henson. I'm not going to look down on Disney for using these characters and trying to update these characters and bring these characters to a new generation, because certainly I don't want the Muppets to kind of pass into obscurity as a relic of the 70s, you know? On the other hand, 30 Rock with Muppets is maybe not necessarily the thing I'm the most interested in seeing when it comes to the Muppets.
Yeah,
but I'm not vehemently opposed to it. It's just not what I look for. It's not what I look for the Muppets to provide.
Yeah, and as I said, I mean, it was one of those, when they did that, and it was sort of like, I looked at it and I was like, by the end, the second half of that season that they did, I could see them like figuring out, yeah, this is how we write it, this is how we're gonna, how we can do it. And as we got used to the new setup, the fact that Piggy and Kermit are no longer together, and that he's got a new girlfriend, he's still dating pigs, because that's apparently his thing. And there was this real will they, won't they get Kermit and Piggy back together. And I thought that was really interesting to see. And the fact that they weren't just going over the same sort of plot lines again made it really sort of interesting. And I just feel that if we had a second season, it would have really come into its own as a show. But unfortunately, it's sadly not to be as of the time of recording. So,
And let's be honest, that's just the story of American television. You know,
there's too much. There's too much to watch, and unless you have a hit straight off, then
right,
they don't want to know.
It doesn't. It doesn't help that unlike in a lot of other countries, our default is not the publicly funded network; it's the commercial network and the I don't want to call PBS a ghetto necessarily, but with so many things rely on purely on, you know, purely on that. What I'm really kind of hoping is that, and I think maybe we've seen a little bit of this or more of this coming with the premium networks over here and with the streaming services, is that things can now kind of have some room to find their voices without the necessity of getting becoming a major hit within seven episodes or being thrown to the wolves.
Yeah.
But I mean, if I had my druthers, I would basically say, yeah, let's institute a license fee in America and fund a new network with that. And of course it would never happen. You know, it's completely and utterly beyond the American cultural mindset. But you know, what can you do? You work with what you got to work with. But yeah, the story of American television is so many shows that, you know, might have taken longer than 13 episodes to find their voices, and for that they were cut and thrown away.
For myself, I still feel that this festive special's one worth watching, and especially if you watch it around Christmas time, it's that sort of disposable, easy to watch viewing that makes it work so well. And it's all your favorite Muppets being brought together and doing what they do, and I think that's what's nice about it. And it's not one of those things that you have to have watched as a kid to really appreciate. I mean, I discovered it a couple of years back.
Right.
I came to it as a Muppets fan, and I just got a kick out of it as it was. I think I just was really charmed by it, the same way I was charmed by Pee-wee's Playhouse Christmas Special as well. It's just that same level of, you know, festive charm to it.
I had forgotten that you had mentioned that the main bit of praise I have for that, this, I had forgotten that you had mentioned the Fraggles were in this. So it wasn't until we got to the point where they introduced the Fraggles that I realized that this was made in the 80s. it felt so much like it could have been a production that they'd done in the 70s.
Yeah. And, yeah, I mean, it doesn't go into any of the darker sort of themes that Henson occasionally tapped into with things like The Storyteller and perhaps even Emmett Otter to an extent.
Or Dark Crystal.
Yeah, exactly. This is, as I said, this is the Muppets level of things, so it doesn't go dark, and it's, as I say, it's just a really wholesome time, and I think it's one that's still worth discovering. It's very easy to get a hold of, so definitely worth checking out if you've got even just sort of the passing interest in the Muppets, I would say.
Yeah, it's definitely a worthy addition to the Muppets canon.
Cool. Anything else that you want to bring up in this one?
That's about it.
Okay. Well, this brings us to the end of another edition of TV Good Sleep Bad. We hope you've enjoyed it, and we hope you all have a wonderful festive season of food comas and TV binges, and join us again in 2019, where we'll be taking further dives into the darker recesses of cult TV goodness. And Lucky, I mean, how do you want to kick off 2019?
Frog baseball! Dun, 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 dun. Episode, the second season, the first episode of Liquid Television, the MTV bizarro animation showcase from the early 90s. And in particular, this is the episode that featured, it was their first, if I recall correctly, it was their first short by a young, hungry, independent animator by the name of Mike Judge. The episode after this is actually, the episode of Liquid Type TV actually that ran after this featured Office Space. But this is where an impressionable generation got their first look at Beavis and Butthead.
Cool. Obviously Liquid TVs, we've previously talked about when we looked at Aeon Flux, so it'd be certainly fun to take another dive into that. As for myself, we're going to look at episode 2, season 1 of Gravity Falls. Probably one of the best shows to come out of the Disney Channel since Phineas and Ferb. This episode, you will see Dipper and Mabel, the brother and sister combo who investigate weird things in the town of Gravity Falls. So, think Erie, Indiana. And this one sees them looking for the lake monster known as the Gobble Wonker. So I'm going to be really interested to see what you make of this one. Because even though it's a Disney show, it's got a real sort of dark edge to it. And because you enjoyed Eerie Indiana, I think you might also get a kick out of this one. So.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of good. I know I've heard a lot of good things about Gravity Falls.
Yeah, only two seasons, which is kind of sad, and it had one of the most heartbreaking final episodes. I was just in bits in the final episode of this show, and as I say, just one of those shows that I just wish went on longer. I think it was great while it lasted, and I just felt there was still more there to be said, but. The episode we're going to look at is certainly one of my favourites, and as I said, that'll be episode 2 of the first season, Legend of the Gobble Wonker. But I'd like to thank everyone for listening. If you haven't done already, please do hit the like and subscribe buttons if you listen to us on Podomatic or iTunes, or through the thatmomentin.com, where we are obviously pro members of the podcast network. You can listen to all the shows via Spotify as well as through the website. Just type in thatmomentin.com and it will all come up there. Farewell for your listening pleasure. Over on the network, though, there is many exciting shows to obviously check out. Over on the Asian Cinema Film Club, they're celebrating Kaiju Christmas by looking at Gamma 3, The Revenge of Iris. Over on Cinema Recall, the Ven is looking at the career of Tilda Swinton in the wake of the release of the new Suspiria remake. We've also uploaded our previous festive specials as well there, so you can check those out as well and see what we made of Emmett Otter and South Park and Pee Wee's Festive Christmas, so they're also up in there. If gaming is more your thing, they are currently looking at their 2018 in review, as well as revealing their top 10 games reviewed for 2018, that is all available through thatmomentin.com, so definitely go check them out. And also like to welcome the newest addition to the network, which is Movie Man Jackson's Cinema Recap. His most recent episode sees them looking not only at the box office, but also the excitement for the new Avengers movie, Endgame. So definitely plenty to check out there. But thank you, as always, for listening. And thank you, of course, my co-host, Mr. Daniel Lucky.
Thank you.
And we'll be back in 2019. So until then, keep it strange.